This year, our podcast will explore the multi-layered experiences which encompass Ireland's past. And we'll also put into context how the sense of heritage is all about our collective experience and why so much that went before still resonates in the present. I hope you enjoy the show. The building which houses the Heritage Council in Kilkenny, which has historic links to former President Barack Obama, is one of the oldest continuously used structures in Ireland. The Heritage Council moved into the former Bishop's Palace in 2008, which is now called Oras na Hoidhreachta, following a lengthy programme of conservation works by the OPW and formally opened by President Mary McAleese. The building was originally constructed by Bishop Richard Ladreed, who was bishop from 1317 to 1361. It was constructed using the stone from three parish churches, which had possibly fallen out of use after the devastation caused by the Black Death. The building and the grounds have a deep and fascinating history that goes back as far as 600 AD, including Bishop Ladreed's obsession with combating heresy, and he played a primary role in confronting witchcraft. In today's podcast, Colm Murray, Architecture Officer with the Heritage Council, provides a unique insight into this special building, which has been part of our history for centuries. Colm Murray, Architecture Officer with the Heritage Council, a big welcome to the Heritage Council podcast. How are you, Colm?
I'm not too bad, thanks.
We were having an unusual conversation about French movies and the stories that a building can tell you. Do you want to share your little story with me before we dive in?
Which one, Amelie or Rosemary?
I guess in a way, the two of them were connected in a way.
Yeah.
But you were telling me about Amelie and that French movie and how there were some items that a child had found behind some floorboards, was it?
Yeah, well, you'd watch Audrey Tautou anytime. But in this film, Amelie, this character is, for some reason, finds something behind a skirting border at the back of a wardrobe, a treasure trove of children's toys, tiny little things. And she wonders who owns these and goes on a big search, asking the concierge who used to live in her apartment. Was there a child? What were their names? And there's a terrible mix-up between a kind of an archetypally French mix-up between names. But eventually she finds this middle-aged man who is the former resident of her apartment. And being the character that she is, she doesn't talk to him directly, but places these toys in a place where he would find them on a park bench, I think. And the memory rush that he gets from being confronted with these tiny little souvenirs of his past is a very powerful moment in the film, where he's catapulted back through the 60 or 70 years since he was a child by just finding these little toy trains or a memento of a summer holiday or what have you. And it just goes to show, I suppose, Greg, the connections that buildings have. And we can walk through or live in spaces and be quite unconscious of the people who have been there before. But with a little effort, we can uncover who these people are and find that we have shared experiences and shared lives with them. So that's one of the fascinating things about looking at old buildings and enjoying and exploring their social and cultural memories. And I mean, with us, we're talking about the building that the Heritage Council now inhabits, which is an extraordinarily old building, one of perhaps the oldest continuously used buildings in Ireland, a former Bishop's Palace, dating back to the 1340s, to the time of the Black Death. Yeah, a previous plague.
how did that happen?
Through all that time, there have been people here and momentous events have happened and traces have been left behind in the fabric of the building. As it stands, it looks very much like a Georgian country house plonked in the middle of Kilkenny. Sort of been given that appearance since the 18th century. But there's a thing that's like a tower house at one end of it. And at first we thought that that was the earliest building on site, but it turns out that the tower house was an extension. We've put our glass and steel 21st century pavilion beside that. And when we were trying to find the ground for foundations for that, we discovered an old kitchen wing was that had been there since the 1670s and was leveled and hidden below the tarmac. And we ended up rejigging the modern pavilion in that location and, what would you say, moving the angle slightly so that it sits on the foundations of this old kitchen. And we kind of like that idea that you sort of re-inhabit, reuse the past, build our modern structures on the foundations that are there in the past. And that's that became a lovely metaphor at the time when we opened the building, that heritage is something that is built on the past. And here we are re-inhabiting, reinventing, appropriating something very old and making it our own and making it meaningful in the 21st century.
And it's a beautiful building. And I haven't been there, but I think I saw some of the photographs and some of the features through the website. The history of it is incredible. And you were saying it dates back to when?
To the 1340s or so. The Black Death was bestride the land and ravaged populations. And there was this character, Bishop Richard Ledred, famous in Kilkenny. He was a friar rather than someone from within the church. He was from one of the religious orders. And his effigy is in St. Canice's Cathedral, which is just across the way from where Áras na hÉireachta is. He was a bit of a character now. He's famous in Kilkenny for persecuting Alice Kettler for witchcraft. But he did an awful lot more than that. He was very much a new breed of bishop who wasn't just going along with the flow, tending his temporalities and going off to the manors and distant farms that were part of the church's property. He was saying, no, I'm a religious leader and I'm going to be living right beside the cathedral. And because of all the death and destruction that had happened as a result of the Black Plague, a lot of churches in the vicinity of Kilkenny had fallen completely out of use. So he applied to Rome, to the Pope, to be given permission to demolish these buildings, these three churches, in order to build his Nova Curia, his new house, right next to the cathedral. So that's how we know about the origins of the Bishop's Palace and its date. So Ledred got the Pope's permission to demolish three churches and use the stones to build a place for himself right beside the cathedral. And when we were doing the works to the building in 2007 or so, we took the render off the building and found underneath the various different forms of stone in different places on the building. So we reckon we've got some small bit of evidence that we can see the pieces of the building that Ledred built. They're in the form of a kind of a what's called a hall house. And that's the big ground and first floor of that you see in our photographs of the main facade. And then everything else is an extension onto that. It went up a story. There was a piece built at the back. The tower house is added on as an extension and so on. A beautiful staircase built in the 1730s. And even through that time, Kilkenny was besieged and taken by Cromwell in 1650. And it was said that the bishop's palace and the cathedral itself were used for keeping pigs and horses. And for 10 or 15 years, it was totally, what would you say, left as a normal, its value was as a normal building, as something that maybe someone used as a house or maybe was just used as stables. It was disrespected. And come what was called the Restoration then, when Charles II took over in the UK, the King of England, and the Church of England was restored and the bishop came back and was appointed to Kilkenny, we discovered then that the building had to be redone. And we've discovered actually a note from this guy, Bishop Perry. And apparently in the National Library, there's some documentation, an actual building contract that he made in September 1672 with three builders to remake windows and doors in the building. So there's these guys, J. Middleton and J. Dowling and P. Hayden, who make contract with the bishop to repair the windows in 16th of September 1672. And amazingly, during the course of the works, we actually discovered one of these windows. It had been covered over with mortar and stones on the outside and plastered over on the inside. But we've got the window frame and we now know the names of the guys in 1672. How many years ago is that? 350 years ago.
Yeah.
Who were these actual guys who made this window frame. It's not like what we think of as a historic window, a timber sash window. It's an older style of window than that. It would have been a kind of a simple rectangular frame with a divided into four parts by a cross shaped. They're called a transom and a mullion. And then there'd have been leaded glass in two of those squares, and the other two would be openable with leaded glass in them. So bits of this survive in the building. So these tangible links, that's 350 years, and that's not even bottoming out the whole history of that building. There's 200 years before that, you know. It's incredible. It was 300 years before that. So this thing has been around for a long time. There's reputed to be a ghost in the building, although I've never met him. But
only one.
Well, it's hard, even if you don't believe in ghosts, it's hard not to believe that some essence or residue of all of these people who lived here and worked here before might hang around in the mortar and the plaster and the old timber, the way some spiders do, you know, that there's some sense of these stories being there.
What do you think, Cullum? Do you think the people who inhabit it leave something behind?
Well, I don't believe in spirits, but I do believe that these memories can linger for sure. You're more inclined to hear and believe stories and resonate with things that are very old.
Yeah. And we were having that conversation about memories, and you were sharing a story with me, some lady who knocked on the door.
Yeah.
And she shared, I think, the same view that you have from your office.
That's right. Rosemary. Rosemary was a child in the building in the 1950s. Through unfortunate circumstances, her father, who had been a clergyman, died, and her mother came to work with the bishop. And her mother brought the bishop around to the various churches on Sunday and left her alone in the building. Of course, she was quite safe, but a little bit alone, a little bit lonely. So she told me when we walked into my office that she spent Sunday afternoons looking out the window at a marble cherub on a grave in the cathedral. And she made friends with and had conversations with this cherub. And of course, they're still there. The cherub is still there on the other side of the laneway. And it's just extraordinary, the things that people see when they're looking out the same window that I might never have seen. I would have been looking at the streetscape and the trees and the magnificent east window of the cathedral through my architect's eyes. And here's an entirely different view at the same window. Someone makes a connection with something else. But also very poignant to imagine the life of that child played out in this room that now is busy with computers and full of books and so on. That it had a different resonance and a different spirit for a small girl in the 1950s.
The Giant's Causeway. The connection with the Giant's Causeway and the Bishop's Palace. What's the connection, Cullum?
Well, the Giant's Causeway is at the other end of the country. But in the 1750s, the famous Bishop Richard Pocock, a peripatetic bishop, he wandered everywhere and wrote about every place that he visited. He was the bishop in Kilkenny, the Bishop of Ossory at that time. And he is said to have taken one of the basalt columns from the Giant's Causeway to his bishop's palace in Kilkenny and to have displayed it there. Now, we haven't found it. We're not going to dig up the entire garden, but we hope that maybe somewhere in some forgotten corner, there's a tiny piece of the Giant's Causeway. Even though we didn't go looking for that, at the time when we were taking care of the robing room and about to do it up, we did a bit of excavations and we found something quite different. Colleen O'Driscoll, an archaeologist, dug just a few small little trenches, 6 inches, 9 inches, maybe a meter deep in the soil of the garden. And when we got down below the topsoil, we discovered things like antler combs, and the changes in the soil suggested a kind of an enclosure, a circular, a huge big circular ditch. So we figured out that we were looking at the monastic enclosure for this kind of hilltop religious settlement before the grand Gothic cathedral was built, maybe around the time the Round Tower was built, maybe even before that, when this was a holy place for St. Canice. And what they discovered was, they call it like nearly the first city of Kilkenny, the first place of inhabitation. And they were very careful. The archaeologists are very careful about this. They figure if it's a place where you find that someone lived, it's a house. But if you find that things are being manufactured by a specialist organization of people, it's a town. So the fact that these pieces of antler that were being turned into combs, that there were loads of these and in different stages of completion, this made the settlement not a house, but a town, because manufacturing was happening here. So right in the grounds of the Bishop's Palace, before all of the religious dimension of the place, the bishop, the cathedral, there may have been the very original town of Kilkenny, a place where groups of people lived together, where work was shared and specialized, and therefore specialist manufacturing can happen. And that is what we found in the grounds of the palace as well. So it tells a story that goes even farther back than this religious inheritance.
So Kilkenny started there.
Yeah, yeah.
Potentially.
Yes, no, indeed, yes. Kilkenny Castle, the big strong point at the other end of the town, about a mile, 1.6 kilometers away, that was a Norman thing. And the castle was situated there because it was better defended. But this hillock with a religious thing on the top, right beside, overlooking the river at a possible crossing point of the river, that made sense geographically as a place for a very old settlement. He was very disparagingly called the dullest man that ever traveled. But he wrote a lot. He wrote about where he had been. And I suppose his remarks became a little bit dulled by repetition or by not seeing anything new. But he traveled as a young man with his cousin, who became a bishop as well in Waterford. And they went as far as Turkey, and they did what you do in Turkey. They dressed up in Turkish costume and had themselves painted. So there's an extraordinary picture of the young Pocock in a fez and in the flowing robes of a Turkish sultan. So I think it's really not fair to call him dull.
Yeah, there was a bit of adventure in him.
Yeah, and he's reputed to have built an extraordinary structure in the grounds of the palace called the Robing Room. Now, we discovered that it's only been called the Robing Room since the 1960s, and it wasn't called that beforehand. We don't know why. It looked obvious that it was situated on a route, a ceremonial processional route from the palace to the cathedral, and that this is the place where the bishop would don his robes before entering the cathedral in formal attire. And we've conserved and repaired that room in the last few years. And during the course of the repairs, for example, we discovered that there was a little fireplace in the basement, and the chimney was not above it, but in an entirely different location. And we discovered that the smoke from the fireplace was brought up into a built-in bench in the robing room and brought all the way around the edge of the robing room before being sent into the flue that brought it up to the top. So you have this vision of an entourage of altar boys or subservient deacons and vicars sitting around, at least having their bums warmed while waiting for the bishop to put on his robes or to appear after breakfast and before service. But he's also reputed, and I really don't give much credence to this, but he's reputed to have built the robing room for amorous liaisons. So again, going against his reputation for being the dullest man that ever traveled, he certainly appears to have at least caused rumors, if not actually got up to amorous liaisons in the robing room.
Yeah, maybe he wasn't the dullest guy of all time.
Certainly not, no.
And there's a link then to famous presidents, I believe.
Yeah, well, we got very excited when President Obama started declaring his Irish roots, where he said he was coming to Ireland in search of the missing apostrophe, the O before Bama. But yeah, he was related to a guy called John Kearney, who was Bishop of Ossory from 1806 to 1813, and who therefore lived in the Bishop's Palace. There's a memorial for him in St. Canice's Cathedral. And in the palace, some of the fancier and larger rooms were built at around this time. They have what was called the Regency style in decoration of in architecture, with a particular type of shutter and cornices and centerpieces in plasterwork in the middle of the ceilings. So we think he was responsible for building what we now call our community room, but which was at the time a dining room, and the saloon above it, which then became, was then called a withdrawing room, a drawing room, or a living room, as we'd call it now. So we think that Bishop Kearney, the great, great, great granduncle of Barack Obama, may have been responsible for commissioning parts of the building that we now have.
And Colin, from an architectural point of view and the things in the building, now you've mentioned some of them, but the parts that are quite significant for architects, for students of architecture, or maybe even for the ordinary layperson, things that you're not going to see anywhere else.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's one spectacular space in the building, which is our staircase. And we know this was built in 1739 by a guy called Bishop Este. It's got all the characteristics of the style of that period, and it's got a magnificent ceiling above it. So you can walk into the building and this is the wow space. But in another sense, I kind of like the intricate history, the mystery, actually, as opposed to the history of the building. The sense that there are many contradictory pieces of fabric, and there are things that we don't actually know yet. There's a vault that points off in one direction, and we don't know why that was there. There's two staircases in the tower. We don't know why there were two staircases. There are locked up windows, and we don't know what was behind them. So it's a building that forces us, even in our familiarity, to keep an open mind about how it might have been used in the past. We discovered when we were doing the works this fabulous brick floor in one area, which is called the butler's pantry on some drawing. And was that the way a butler used it? Did it have a rough brick floor like that, or what? We don't know. So we have to just live with that sense that the past might be telling us something, might be in code, it might be demanding that we know more, but we just have to live with that. We have to live with this mystery. I think, as I say, more mystery than history. And it, just to think about that, you asked a question about architecture, and yes, there are spaces that are magnificent and grand rooms and so on. But there's also this sense of those spaces, and I talked about people who lived in the building and how they may have left their mark or carried specific memories of how they inhabited it. So all of these things make it a kind of a cat's cradle of associations and things to think about and things that might be there or might not, that kind of enrich your imagination as you walk around it. And I think that is the architectural experience that I think is the best thing about the building.
The stairwell column. Obviously, that wasn't built by local builders.
Well, we don't know that. Funnily enough, rather than starting with the stairwell, the doorway, the door case, the fancy stone surround to the main door into the building is, as it happens, I found the exact design of that doorway in a book by a guy called William Halfpenny or Halfpenny. He was around in the 1730s, and he was kind of one of these craftsman joiners who knew that the best way to make money and get your name known was to publish a book. And he published a few books on how pattern books on how to do architecture. And one of these books contains an exact match for the doorway in our building. So he, for example, he lived in Waterford, but he came from, I think, Bristol in England. He would have been local and a tradesman as well as a designer. And I think there may have been a group of craftsmen who were able to execute good classical timber work or plaster work that were shared through the elite culture of bishops and the ascendancy in Ireland. Yes, this is possible, and fluid boundaries between craftsmen in Ireland and in England. But to say that they're not local would be a little unfair. They might spend quite a few years in Ireland or in Kilkenny doing work for different people. Apparently, for example, there's a strong connection between the former Bishop's Palace, our building, and another building just outside Kilkenny called Bonnetstown Hall, which appears to have been built at around the same time and contains the same atmosphere and detailing. So it's quite possible that there was local culture of good building in Kilkenny, in Ireland, in Leinster. Who knows? It depends on how you want to define those things. So,
yeah, and I think in a way, my assumption was, you know, if there were unique pieces here, that they had to have come from somewhere else. And that idea that we'd reach overseas to bring, you know, specific craftspeople in to build these pieces. But you were saying there's a good chance we had all of that skill set here on our own shores.
Yes, yes, I think so. I mean, it's a thread in recent Irish architectural history to assert and emphasize that whilst we can call the architecture, the classical architecture, almost by definition, architecture is this universal global thing that is recognizable anywhere. And so there's a sense that architecture, modern architecture, classical architecture, Gothic architecture is an idea that was born somewhere and then spread across the world to take it over. And we can understand time as some great style ripples outwards from some given origin. But I think it's a lot more than that. Every building is built. Every building is understood by people locally. And every door, every window, every piece of carved timber was done by someone who went home for their dinner, you know, and got up in the morning and had their soup, maybe not their tea. So I think that buildings are more rooted in places than we acknowledge. And people, local people, people from a place contribute to or actively take on board these big languages of architecture and ingest them and learn them and then produce them. So, you know, these things are, it's a different way of looking at what it is to say a building is a certain style or that it comes from a certain place. So I think we can be proud in Ireland of the craftsmanship that produced buildings that maybe to the template of an international style, but they were built by Irish people.
I'm sure we need to mine our old buildings in all of our places because they make for beautiful places, don't they?
Well, certainly, yes. Again, I'm struck by the sense of whether an architect makes a place or whether the people who live there make a place. The places, the buildings that I love are ones where, yes, you might have some grand declamatory statement of design, but you also have inhabitation. You have a couch that's been moved to a certain location or a door that's been changed around because a connection is necessary, a certain lifestyle demands it. And that knocking the edges off grand architecture to make places that are habitable and then because of that are enduring. And then because of that are rich with memories. That, I think, is what's very special about old places, that they have endured and been passed from one generation to the next and used in the passing and enjoyed and then handed on. That's really what makes certain places special. And yeah, you find it in old places.
And once you go outside the actual building itself, I believe, the medieval city walls run across the garden.
Well, yeah, they used to. another bishop found his gardens too small when they were contained by the city wall. So he bought the land on the other side. Actually, there was a lane outside the city wall and there was small cottages on the lane. So he bought the lot, knocked it. So we had that as well. That only happened in the middle of the 19th century. So, yeah.
The importance of knowing the history of our buildings, you know, these places we walk past every day, it becomes a different thing when we know the story of what came before.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are grand stories. Yes, there are events of our past that are etched into buildings. But I actually think that what interests people is the human beings that were there before. I mean, it's strange how families move in and out of houses, if you like. In fact, there are many houses where families hand them on from generation to generation. This does happen too. But it is possible to, this is a crusty complaint I have about a long lost battle. But back in 1977, the government, a political party, won an election by abolishing domestic rates. I won't go into it, but domestic rates were abolished in 1977. And domestic rates had been, the record of domestic rates had been kept since 1850. And it's an incredible record, of who lived where, who paid the rates on individual houses, a comprehensive record across the country. So you can see who lived in every single house in Ireland. I know these records because they also tell when things were built and when the valuation of a building, a house, a hotel, a factory increased during that period of time. But to begin with, that's a place where family histories can be traced in relation to buildings. I gave information like this to a friend of mine in Letterkenny, Donan Harvey, and he was able to trace the people who lived in Church Lane in Letterkenny. And he did something more. He went and found the descendants of those people using Facebook, internet searches, and he invited them back to Church Lane in Letterkenny. And that was a really powerful experience for those individuals who might have been living in Liverpool or God knows in France or maybe even in Dublin. And for them to come back and say, you know, your people came from here, from this place. It's a really powerful thing. And to reconnect people and families to houses, buildings, can be, it's easily enough done. And it is a very powerful thing when it is done.
So the Bishop's Palace is now the headquarters for the Heritage Council. How many people work in the building, Colm?
Well, we are 19 now. We've just recently expanded as a workforce to include new and greatly welcomed colleagues to help us with our work. But yeah, 19 people. And we're a national organization, not just Kilkenny, not Leinster, but we look at Ireland and indeed Irish heritage across the world. And I think we're hoping also to look at heritage of all peoples that might be found in Ireland. So we're a staff of 19. We've got enough desks, chairs, and computers. So we'll be trying to work our project of raising awareness and appreciation of heritage from a building that we now call Áras na hÉireachta. We've been asked to leave the name Bishop's Palace behind, even though that's quite hard because it's been there for 700 years. And because it's a building that is a landmark, a big white cube that can be seen above the rooftops in Kilkenny City, right beside the east window of St. Canice's Cathedral and just there beside the round tower, these ancient monuments. So we take our place on the skyline and of the city and hopefully in the national consciousness as well.
Yeah, and the practicalities of running, you know, a modern organization from a building that was, I think we're saying was built in 1735, but it originated way before that. Is that a practical thing? Does that even work?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've always said that I think we must inhabit our old buildings. Stone has been raised upon stone. Timber has been strung across between stone walls and floorboards put on it and roofs put over it. These structures exist. They embody carbon. They are usable spaces. They're a material asset as well as a historical and a cultural one. So it's an imperative, I think, that we make use of the spaces that we have. So yes, we have an unusually rich place. We've repaired the sash windows. We've repaired the roof. We've re-rendered the walls. We've put in some wiring to make our computers work, to make the lights go on. There's plumbing. These things are possible in every old and historical building. And sure, there might be some extra issues and care that's to be taken to not disturb those spirits and to leave some of the mystery behind. But once you do those things, you can have an eminently practical place in which to live, and maybe a richer place because of all of these associations. And did I use this word already? The beauty of working in an old building, high ceilings, considered decoration, orderly plans, all of these things. Yeah. I mean, right now we're looking at the issue of how much energy the building uses. We're a public sector body, and we're going to have, we've achieved targets to reduce energy use by one third by 2020. And now the government is setting new targets for us to reduce energy use over 2015 levels by 2030. And that's a big challenge. But like every other building, we're going to try and step up to that challenge, make the windows less drafty, figure out how to turn the lights off more, not turn them on, use less heat, etc. So these are the challenges of living in and working in any building, whether it's very old or just old or actually quite new. They're the same challenges that our entire building stock is facing. So we're going to try and take those on and make sure that it remains a relevant building, a building that can be lived in and used and worked in.
Tell me, do the general public get an opportunity to see the building at any point in time?
We're a public body. We like to think of this as something that we share with people. Now, the last year and a half have been dismal from the point of view of opening anywhere to anyone. But and we'll have to pull our socks up and rethink that. We have a room that we call the community room, which is in principle available for people to meet in and to hold seminars and so on. God be with the days. Hopefully we'll have them again. And during Heritage Week and at other times of the year, we do give tours of the building. People sometimes do wander up and have a look around, but that's harder to manage. So we try to keep it to the times when people come by arrangement, whatever that might be.
Okay. Colm, is it safe to say it's as much about the mystery as it is about the history?
Yeah. I'd like to think about it like that. There's a sense in which we must sit back and wonder and not have answers to questions.
Colm Murray, Architecture Officer with the Heritage Council. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Heritage Council podcast. For more information about our projects and programs, our work with others, and our publications, please check our website, heritagecouncil.ie. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn, or subscribe to our YouTube channel. See you again soon.